Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Chelsea Echo. Welcome to your preview of Wolves away, Chelsea's second outing in the Premier League this season to a bogey ground of sorts. Not for everybody, though, because there is a certain man who does this podcast that has won a trophy at Wolves, and I won't get into that. It is myself, it is Daniel Childs, and Tom will be coming in with his stats of a shagging nature later on in the show. But Dan, how we doing, mate? How are you feeling after watching Servette last night?
Oh, I'm very enthralled. It's weird. I travelled back from London this morning, and when I left, it was kind of chucking it down, and it sort of felt like October and summer had died. And I've got back, and it's like summer weather again. So it's kind of cheered me up. I've realised the Bundesliga starts tonight, so I'll be enjoying a bit of that later. So yeah, I mean, listen, it's the weekend. It's bank holiday weekend, so you got to be positive, I guess.
Yeah, man, absolutely. With the Bundesliga stuff, because I've always wondered this, right? In COVID, you know when everyone sort of did that test to figure out which team they were, which team did you land on for the Bundesliga?
I'm trying to remember who I watched the most. I love Gladbach, who are playing tonight against Leverkusen, because I went to see Gladbach versus Chelsea. So I had sort of, that was my first German-based game. So obviously I've had somewhat of an affiliation with them. I remember watching them a lot during COVID. So I'd probably say Gladbach. I like a little bit of Union Berlin. Of course, they only got recently promoted, but I don't think they were in. I'm pretty sure they won in the Bundesliga when COVID. I think they were in Bundesliga 2. I remember watching some Bundesliga 2 games. There was nothing great about lockdown, but I do remember those kind of late summer nights, me and my dad just watching Bundesliga football. And I was like, felt a very unique time in history. You know what I'm saying? Probably never happening again.
Yeah, no, it was exactly the same me and my dad. I remember literally sitting there, me and him, we did the test. I think it was at that time, BT Sport, obviously now TNT, they did like the test of which team are you, so they gave you all the questions. And we both ironically landed on Gladbach as well. So Gladbach became the German team for us. And it has nothing to do with the first scene in Gavin and Stacey when Smithy's talking about the type of beer that's brewed near Mönchengladbach FC. But that's by the by. We're not here to talk about Mönchengladbach. This is not a Mönchengladbach podcast. If you want that, I'm sure there's some good ones out there that me and Dan can probably go digging for. But other than that, mate, should we get straight into it? Let's talk about Servette. Let's talk about Man City. You and I obviously met at the pub with Gary after the Man City game and kind of drowned our sorrows because we weren't sure where to go with everything. I mean, let's talk Man City first. Going into the Premier League against a side this Sunday in Wolves, who are a bogey outfit for Chelsea, I think it's fair to say. And confidence for myself is not great. How are you feeling after watching Manchester City at the weekend?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't exactly a disaster, but it wasn't a success. I was quite stunned seeing some of the analysis post-game that suggested that Chelsea were kind of unlucky. I just didn't feel that was the case watching the game on the ground. I think the phrase I've used and others have used, it felt like City had Chelsea at an arm's length for the majority of the game. And I think if I want to be really brutal, it kind of felt like watching a newly promoted side come up against one of the big boys in the Premier League, give them a few scares because it's their first Premier League game. But the destiny of the game was always going in one direction. And unfortunately, that was really the case. I mean, I just can't get out of my mind like 12 months ago when we played Liverpool on the opening day of the season when we probably should have beat them. And then, of course, the City game last year. And people may say that's unfair, but you know, I think that, you know, Chelsea are a lot more than just a minnow. I don't think we should be walking away from City games feeling like, well, you know, we didn't get battered 5-0. Like, that's not really, for me, the barometer. That's not saying I expect to beat Man City, but I think it needed to be. I don't think it was a good enough performance where I can walk away and go, and I think we spoke about this pre-game last week, that you could walk away from it and go, okay, right, City are a better team, obviously. They're miles in front of us. You understand that. But clearly, like, I felt energised. The crowd felt energised. We scored against them. The attack looked good. And you could sort of see in, like, 2 to 3 weeks, this will get better. I don't think it was that. It wasn't exactly as bad as pre-season. So, yeah, I think that, especially the way the game ended, you know, City just kind of killed it. And I think the crowd were kind of dead by the time the full-time whistle came around. So, yeah, listen, it wasn't an amazing start to the season, and I think there are some key issues tactically that I looked at on my podcast where, you know, Maresca has to be focusing on and improving, because I can see, you can say, oh, it's Man City, but these are things that teams are going to regularly try and exploit, I think, on a weekly basis.
Yeah, I mean, I felt the same. I think the way that we faced off against Man City, look, you and I made the joke 2-3 weeks ago, I'm comparing it to Sarri, where, you know, people are going to start using possession stats as small victories. When you saw people saying, well, we controlled the ball against Manchester City, we controlled the ball when Manchester City wanted us to control the ball. That was the biggest issue. I think that there wasn't really anything where we actually laid a glove on them in any situation. And I thought, you know what? Well, looking forward, you know, we had Servette. That was going to be a game where hopefully we could really bolster confidence, really push on. And I mean, I wasn't at the ground. Obviously, you were. Was the atmosphere similar in any ways? Was it a game where people were bored of this party, party, bang, bang, should we call it already? Or is it something where, you know, there is positives to be taken from that game as well? Aside from the obvious of a very professional performance and a thoroughly good win.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I've already seen in the first two games people having a go, sections of people having a go at fans for being too negative. Now, listen, maybe we talk about this on a separate podcast. I don't want to sit here all day, but I think that, you know, the idea that the fans were so toxic that there was no support for the players, I just don't think is a fair reflection. For me, they kind of, yeah, sure, okay, there were segments where you could kind of feel that overwhelming kind of negativity or feeling about wider things around the club kind of getting out a little bit. But I didn't feel those first two games were anything out of the ordinary based on someone who, and like you, who've gone to Stamford Bridge all of their lives. Like, I felt, wow, this is a really unique atmosphere. The only thing I would say about Servette was booing at halftime. That's a record. That's like a new record in terms of your second home game of the season. And just, I'll put this right here. Rather than people saying you're part of the problem, it's a disgrace you booing the players in the second game of the season, rather people should be more curious as to why that's happening so early. If you actually ask the question, why is that happening? Because it shouldn't be happening. How can fans this early into the season, when nothing really has happened, in a game where Chelsea are expected to win with a new manager, feel that way? Now, it was part of the performance. The performance in the first half was terrible. Let's not beat around the bush. You know, you can make the excuse against City that they're Man City. Servette in their last home league game got battered 6-0 by Basel. I think they lost their last away league game 3-1, and I watched some of their football, and listen, they're not a good team. They're not a high caliber football team. But I think as that first half went on, Chelsea didn't look much better than them. And I think it almost felt like Servette started to realise that, yeah, we're playing Chelsea the name, but the quality of the team isn't really there. And it was a much more even game than I think it should have had any right to be, right? And it comes back to wider conversations. I think Joe Tweed's put a really good tweet out post-game that I got sent that, you know, if being disingenuous and people try and make out that people are being overly negative because of two games or one game, it's not. It's 2 years, and it's a load of money spent. And I'm watching us against Servette, and I'm seeing a team, I'm looking across the team, and in terms of just names and quality, I'm going, I don't think this is a great talent in terms of team. The players we're discarding, I don't think are worse than the players we've got on the pitch. And the football just looks really shoddy, like to a point where it's very hard to see at the moment. I keep on saying this, right? There's got to be things that you buy into. And there wasn't much. Like, Chelsea didn't really kill the tie. I think if I'm Servette, I'm walking away from it going, if that game plays out again at our home ground and maybe we finish a chance, we could be back into this tie. So it's not an outstanding day. It's a positive because we won, we got a clean sheet. But if Jorgensen for me is kind of the standout performer, if you push me for one, and I don't really want to be talking about the goalkeeper as our standout performer against Servette. I don't know if I... Sure, it could have been 3-0. Guiu should have scored from an open goal. He absolutely should have. But other than that, I mean, you kind of are scratching to try and find a sense that this was a dominant performance by Chelsea that I think it needed to be. It was a win. Nkunku scored. Madueke finished nicely. But by no means was this an overwhelmingly dominant display that I think a lot of people turning up to the Bridge expected.
Yeah, no, I think that is the biggest problem we're facing. I think that... It's as you said, it's 2 years. And I think that's why people are so tired. And again, like you said, buying into it. I mean, it just feels very much a case of, we're buying you a player, you have to buy into what we're doing, this is what we're doing, you just have to. It's like, okay, well, I'm not someone who, as you're not, someone who just blindly follows. I'm going to ask questions. I want to understand. That's the only reason why I think for myself personally, why I'm so just blasé, I feel is the best word to use about Chelsea at the minute. You know, I look at it and I'm a bit like, well, I don't know what we are. I don't know what we're looking at here. What's the future? What's the plan? Because nobody from the club has been very clear in saying what it is. What I will say, though, is there are some positives within this Numeresco reign, which I am a big fan of. And they are on display in his pre-match press conference. Because I think it's fair to say that, look, as much as fans we are unsure of where the club is going and what direction it is, there are small positives, and using Enzo Maresca as an example, you know, I think having him front and centre, unfortunately, he is going to be the one who takes the brunt of criticism from the fans. He's the one that's, you know, on display rather than the people who really are making these decisions in the sporting director roles, I think is the real one saying, and some in an ownership capacity. But I loved how clear and concise Enzo Maresca is. I love, he's the one now where I'm more open, I think, where I want to, because he's so clear in how he wants to do things, I really rate and value that. I don't know about you, but I mean, just the way that he holds himself, I think it definitely gives a positive in a time where we're so unsure of where things are going.
I mean, I think that for me with Enzo so far, I do agree that some of his answers have been forthright and a little bit aggressive. I don't think that's a bad thing. You know, I think the one that's come out is him saying it's not a mess. I understand he wants to defend his position, but there is kind of a thing where I respect his, as you say, his kind of, he wants to clarify things. But there is kind of, it's kind of hard to defend stuff at the moment at Chelsea. And you kind of are having to kind of warp reality to defend it. Now, he's been employed by the club only a couple of months ago, so I don't expect him to come out Conte style like he already has done at Napoli and start like getting, you know, the guns out and you know, making threats that he's going to be walking out anytime soon. I did see someone say that it's not great that it already feels like he's giving press conferences that in like late August that you'd expect him to be given in like December. So we'll see how that develops, right? I don't disagree that to be in that position, he needs to have a strong character. He needs to have a strong head on him. He needs to have conviction. It's just everything around him that I think is part of the issue at the moment. Is that going to undermine any of that forthrightness? You know, and you know, there were things about, say, Graham Potter's time that I know a lot of people don't like Potter, but I liked his kind of humility. I liked his honesty at times. I liked that he tried to, in like a whirlwind in a storm, he was trying to be kind of a calm head. But unfortunately, you just are kind of battling against a lot of noise. So I will have to see how that develops. You know, I think for fans at the moment, I don't really blame them for not fully buying in and waiting to see what happens a bit, because really that's what's going to define, unfortunately, Enzo Maresca. You know, it's all right having these nice press conferences, and I do agree that good press conferences matter. I think it's why we fell in love with Jose so much. It's why, of course, Thomas Tuchel quite recently connected with fans very quickly. He was a master at press conferences. Of course, it needs to be coupled with convincing performances. It kind of just, to me, it feels like at the moment Enzo Maresca is doing a very good spin Dr. Alistair Campbell job. And again, people may think I'm being really harsh on him. Like, he's doing what he should be doing as a good employee to Chelsea Football Club. Whether that actually makes a very, very good football team, I'm not entirely sure. So I'm sorry that I don't share your overwhelming enthusiasm.
My enthusiasm is only in the press conferences. It's a small win for me in what has been a very dire 18 months, 2 years. You know, that's why I like the way he talks. I'm kind of going, cool, this is great, keep doing that, set your barometers. I think he does need to engage with the fans a bit at the ground. I mean, at the City game, he walked straight to centre circle, shook hands with all the players, walked straight down the tunnel. I'm like, if there's any time for you to engage with people, you need to do it now. You need to go round the stands and sort of just, you know, get people going and try and win people over outside of those press conferences. And also, like you said, the football has to match that power in the press conferences. You know, if he's saying all this stuff about, you know, needing Chelsea to be at a certain level and, you know, how he wants players to be, okay, well, you have to get the results then to back that up. That is just unfortunately how it works. Football is a results-driven business. Saying where anything is needs to be given time and be given opportunities. Absolutely, that needs to be the case. But a very strong base was given to Enzo Maresca for Chelsea the season from last season. You know, Pochettino was, if you look at the statistics, if Chelsea had beaten Aston Villa at the beginning of last season rather than lose that fixture at Stamford Bridge, they'd be in the top four. We'd be in Champions League football. You know, that's very much a case of, okay, that's the fine margins which Chelsea were dealing with last year. So, you know, that's the benchmark that he's got. And I think that's what he needs to match up with. So, I mean, Europa League is probably what he needs to be pushing for. That's me being, you know, pessimistic. But we'll have to see how all of that goes. Of course, obviously, as well, there is other bits we need to talk about from the Servette and Manchester City games, but it kind of ties in quite nicely with the preview, and we will be going into that later on in the show. But first, because you didn't get your transfer supplement on Sunday, I thought it'd be might nice for me and Dan to sit down and talk some transfers, because Chelsea have undoubtedly, obviously they're going to be, it's Chelsea Football Club under, you know, the Clear Lake ownership, are going to be very busy in the final 7 days of the window, and me and Dan have definitely got to talk about that. So Daniel, where should we start? I've got three options for you. Do you want to go with Victor Osimhen? Two options, actually. Victor Osimhen or Raheem Sterling? Where should we start?
Let's start with Victor Osimhen, because I think it's going to be quicker to speak about Osimhen.
And I was like, let's just get this and rip this off like a plaster. Okay, so Victor Osimhen to Chelsea. We had Rahman Osman come on our spaces earlier on in the week. And we were discussing, obviously, João Felix coming to Chelsea Football Club, and how does that tie in with transfers and signings? And we probably should touch on João Felix as well, because that's a whole other conversation we need to dissect. But Victor Osimhen to Chelsea could potentially be seemingly getting closer. His agents were coming out and basically saying what his wages are, and it's just under £300,000 a week gross. So net, he's on less. With all of that being said, do you think that Victor Osimhen is someone which Chelsea are going to actually get their hands on in the last 7 days of the window? Or is it going to be another false start for Chelsea, which is relying on a transfer strategy that hasn't worked so far to work so that we can get someone through the door?
In some ways, I think it is slightly dependent on what happens in the upcoming games. You know, I think that as much as the club likes the brief about how long-term everything is, I also think you can look at certain major decisions they have made that arguably are much more reactive. You know, I'm thinking of the sacking of Graham Potter. I'm thinking of some of the transfer decisions that have been made, especially like players that were bought that kind of you do kind of wonder in retrospect, like how much of a plan that was. I mean, João Felix is kind of like that, but I mean, that kind of feels like more of an accounting trick than, or kind of a scratching the back of Atletico Madrid whilst we give them one of our best players, which, you know, it's crazy to think that transfers used to be about improving your football team, not helping out other teams whilst you give them your best players. But in the case of Osimhen, if you ask me now, I can't see it happening just purely based on what I'm reading. Now, I think if Chelsea weren't to win against Wolves in a disastrous scenario, somehow don't come through the tie against Servette, you know, I think the overwhelming noise will maybe force the hand of Chelsea. Now, whether you think that's right or wrong, I just think that's the reality. If Chelsea start winning games, they may look at it and go, do we really need Victor Osimhen? And also, I do kind of think, is it another Elise situation where they've kind of quite clearly been happy for this to come out kind of publicly, that Chelsea are in for Osimhen and thinking about it seriously, But when it's come down to it, the finances involved, that you actually have to pay this player quite seriously, and he isn't just going to come on a nice handshake. You know, you have to invest seriously on him. They've kind of backed out again. So I think it might be results dependent, and there may also be that classic transfer thing of needs must, because of course he hasn't been involved with Antonio Conte. Conte clearly wants Lukaku. Napoli, you've got to factor in as well, not just from a Chelsea point of view. It's been stressed to me a couple of times now that Napoli, when they gave Osimhen that contract, it was kind of based on the assumption, or contract kind of upgrade for him, it was based on the assumption they were going to sell him this summer, because financially they just can't really sustain paying Osimhen that. So there may come a breaking point, and we saw this with the João Félix move and the Conor Gallagher move, where clubs kind of have to help each other out in a sense, right? So even if Osimhen doesn't want a loan move, it might be a loan that's kind of briefed as a loan, but really it's a permanent move that's very carefully structured, where Chelsea can somehow get around to be able to buy him next summer. I think there's undeniable, it's an undeniable PR win for Chelsea to buy Victor Osimhen. That doesn't mean he's going to be an overwhelming success, but I can't believe his signing won't be met with positivity, because he's a name that excites a lot of people. I still have some concerns about him structurally, fitness wise, and just kind of like servicing him as a centre forward. Like, I think that the idea that Osimhen is going to be framed as the saviour for Chelsea, I just think is a little bit overboard. But still, it's, you've gone this far, why don't you go all the way and get him? Because it kind of feels absolutely strange that we might end this window without addressing centre forward. And that will be a big criticism, an obvious criticism you can make again, that we've spent all this money and again we haven't signed a centre forward.
Yeah, the centre forward situation is something which needs to be addressed very quickly by Chelsea. And, you know, they bang on about data, I think is the best way. Every argument it just boils down to, because that's how they want to operate, data. When it comes down to that situation, Chelsea have not delivered in the centre forward department, yet they continue to believe that, you know, if you sign a young player who's unproven and doesn't, you know, have it at the elite level and has a proven track record at that elite level, that they're just going to expect them to fire us to top four, which I think was, you know, the big, it's the most confusing thing about our strategy, is they want to have time taken and development process in place, but guys, we need to be getting top four every single year. It's like, it doesn't work like that. All the sides around us have that blend of experience and youth, which allows them to be more competitive in that nature. I mean, you know, we were discussing it, you know, a few weeks ago, me and Tom were, and he was saying that realistically, it's not a top four anymore, it's not a top six anymore, it's top 10. Now, there's anyone in the top 10, realistically, aside from the obvious in Manchester City and Arsenal, are competing for the top four in Europe. It's a huge, huge amount of competition. And, you know, the sides around us, I feel, have experience and youth, and they have the balance and spades, which Chelsea don't have. You've hit the nail on the head. I think Victor Osimhen, he fits their bracket in terms of the age, right? But he also fits the bracket in terms of an elite centre forward, as someone who can actually come in and really make a difference. And that's proven. Now, I'm saying that with a lot of hope, and because people be sitting here and listening to the pod and going, well, hang on, Louis, don't you usually say that Italian football's not as good as English football? Don't you say the quality's not there? Yes, I do say that. The quality is not there. But Victor Osimhen has done it at an elite level in France. He's done it in Italy. He fired, you know, Napoli to their first Scudetto in years. You know, for me, that is such a massive, massive thing, which it gets put under the radar. Now, do I expect him to turn 30-goal season in Italy into 30-goal season in the Premier League? We'll see. But I think I'd be far more willing to give Victor Osimhen 6 months, a year to get his feet under the table than I would be if Chelsea were to sign somebody who doesn't have the pedigree again. Now, I think Nicholas Jackson has proved his value last year. You know, there is still a lot missing from his game. His decision-making still isn't as good as it could be, but he's 22 and he scored 17 goals last season in all competitions. That's a big step in the right direction. But for Chelsea to achieve the goals they want to, they need to be really pushing forward to get into those European places.
Yeah, no, I agree that the problem is with Guillou, right, and you saw this against Servette, right, that, you know, you kind of are just trying to buy Jackson again. But the problem is that Jackson 12 months ago was given a lot of room and a lot of time to develop. And I guess my concern with those profile of players now is that it gets quite cluttered. And although Chelsea are likely to have more fixtures this season, there just becomes a natural reality that pressure tolls over the course of a season, and a coach will more often than not pick more experienced players. And in the case of Jackson or Guillou, Jackson is the more experienced player. So will those players get the time to marinate that Jackson did last year? So then you're kind of then looking, well, okay, you've bought Jackson, you've given him that time to develop, he's developed, and that goal return is really impressive based on his trajectory, based on his lack of experience, and actually struggle and pressure to take on that role. You know, the pressure to be a Chelsea centre forward is massive because so many have failed in that role. So, you know, you bring in Osimhen, and sure, maybe there's a concern that Jackson's development could be halted, but I like the fact that Jackson could play wider, so there's a bit of versatility there. And I agree with you, it is kind of just a very brutal world now where Chelsea don't have the luxury they did maybe 6-7 years ago, where you kind of are based on our wages, based on our pedigree, that we're still kind of, unless we're doing something disastrous, we're still going to be better than a majority of teams in the league. Like, so much so that we're probably going to finish third and fourth in a bad year. No longer that case. You know, it is, I'd maybe not a top 10, but you know, it's more the case that those kind of 8, 9, 10 could maybe break into 7th or 6th. Really, I look at it more as a top 7, and it's kind of how that top 7 shakes out over the course of the year. And you have to factor in the change in head coach. So, and I think that Maresca needs help to have players who are going to finish things for him quickly. Because there's just, I keep on going back to this, there's a financial reality. Chelsea have to start winning football matches. They need to start proving that this is going to work. Because there's only so many times you can go to the academy well until it runs dry, which I think is getting close to running dry. Because if you're not willing to get, if you're not going to develop a Gallagher, you're not going to develop a Chalobah in the first team, their ceiling, their kind of value to you, just objectively, if you want to sell them for pure profit, is not going to be there in 12 months.
No, absolutely. And that is the biggest problem, because I don't want to allow those players to develop into the first team. Because, I mean, look, realistically, in terms of sellable assets, and I say that very, very loosely, by the way, because I don't think he is a sellable asset right now. But if something was to happen, then you'd have to think about it. Reece James is probably the last player in that Chelsea squad who is a pure profit sellable asset.
And Colwell.
And Levi
obviously.
Colwell. But then even Levi Colwell's a bit... I mean, I don't know. I mean, Chelsea could have got £40 million from Brighton for him last year. And I don't think you're going to get anywhere near that for Levi Colwell now at all. That's just my personal opinion. But again, you know, I'm hoping he develops. You know, Maresca sees him as a key figure in that back line. But look, this is all doom and gloom from me and Dan. Let's have a laugh now at Raheem Sterling. Because that... I struggle to put into words that entire situation at how ludicrous it is. And I don't think it could play out at very many other clubs in world football.
Oh, no. I mean, it is funny that if that thing that happened an hour before kickoff happened at a majority of other Premier League clubs, it would be a huge story. It would be like sending shockwaves. But because of the absolute mess that has been this summer... it's kind of just like the latest swing. You're kind of like, it's more of a shrug of the shoulders as a Chelsea fan, because you're like, well, another day, you know, another scandal, you know, you're kind of used to it at this point. And yeah, I mean, listen, all round it's a mess. And I am maybe guilty of always looking at the club. I think that whether Sterling believes that that statement should have come out earlier, I don't think it's a great look for him. I think naturally a lot of fans will look at that statement and at the very least go, it doesn't really reflect well on you as a player when it's coming out an hour before kickoff of our first home game of the season. And of course, Sterling is not the most liked player at Chelsea. So I don't think it would have endeared him to them. But then also, and I know this from anecdotal experience and things I've heard from people who are not Sterling's biggest fans. The way then it's kind of flipped back, where he's had his shirt number taken off him before he's been properly sold. He's had kind of the Gallagher and Chalobah treatment of being excluded from first team trailing like Chilwell. And now it's flipped back again, where people are going, well, there's just a way you do things. And it's just, and also you watch Mikhailo Mudryk against Savet and you're kind of like, sorry, Maresca. Again, I go back to the spin doctor thing. It can't be a technical decision. Don't talk to me about he is not the type of winger you want and you're starting Mikhailo Mudryk. Like, we're not, again, we're not talking serious footballing decisions here. No matter the limitations of Raheem Sterling is still a better footballer than Mikhailo Mudryk. He's still 9 times out of 10 going to deliver more than you, more than he will, and he's probably worth more over the course of a season. So I all round, it's an absolute mess. And I think that the concern for me is that Chelsea are kind of going on the assumption you could keep doing this to players and a buyer will come in and then you can get them out of the club. Now, in the case of Gallagher, it worked. I think in the case of Chalobah, it'll work. In the case of Chilwell and Sterling, I'm not entirely sure, because those players are on huge wages. If you're a club who financially are being a little bit more cautious, are you going to spend that on Chilwell, who has a bad injury record? Are you going to spend it on Sterling, who, if I'm investing on a winger, I want to be looking younger than Raheem Sterling at this point? So it's not great. It's all round, it's a complete mess. And these are self-inflicted headlines that the club doesn't really need to. I'm sorry I've gone back to kind of having a go at the club, but I just...
I'm sorry, I just love the way you're going, we're not going to have a go at the club, but I'm going to have a go at the club.
Yeah, I'd say about Sterling, it's not that you can't sell Sterling and like there's no reality where you sell Sterling. I have deep frustrations about Raheem Sterling. He wasn't in my starting 11 for the City game, and I don't think he was in anyone's starting 11 for the City game. But just the way the situations get handled, where if he wasn't part of your plans, why did he play for the majority of pre-season? Why was he handled differently to other players? And the PR reality is that Sterling is not a random player. He isn't Malang Sarr. Sterling is a name that is well known around English and European football. He's a huge name, and you know, you're getting more technical here, but Sterling has a lot of supporters in the media, and when he's getting excluded, that makes headlines. And if he isn't sold before deadline day and he's still being excluded beyond deadline day, if he's around, you only think about the headache that's going to create for Enzo Maresca.
Yeah, no, I think that's the biggest issue. With Mikhailo Mudryk, he was obviously coming out in the post-match presser from Savet saying, we've not seen the best of him yet. And I stand by that. I do think that there is a player in there, but the decision-making process with him needs to be improved, and I don't think that's going to happen in the Premier League. I think he needs a loan move. But, yeah, I mean, look, Raheem Sterling, look, I agree. You know, if he's not sold, then we've got an issue. And I think what we're looking at here, so according to Transfer News, we're looking at three clubs that are interested in Raheem Sterling. That is Aston Villa, Juventus and Crystal Palace. Arguably, only one of those can afford him. And it's not Juventus, unfortunately. So that's a situation where, you know, if we send him...
Can any afford
him? I reckon
him?
Villa could.
I mean, even Villa, like Villa. Well, I think what's going to happen is either Sterling's going to have to maybe lower his asking of wages at this point in his career, because you got to remember Aston Villa, despite their Champions League money, still had PSR problems, which Chelsea helped them out with, if you remember, with Omari Kellerman, if you remember him, like way back years ago when we signed him back in June. So it's, yeah.
Oh Christ.
I think obviously it needs to be done now. It's gotten to that point where he needs to leave the club, and hopefully a resolution can be found. Is that a permanent resolution? I'm not entirely sure, just based on the demands. But if it does materialise that way, great, because I don't see how this continues. It can't, unless he stays and then everyone at the club realizes that, yeah, it probably isn't great if he's being excluded, and you can't keep doing this to big name players, because it probably doesn't create the nicest atmosphere. You have to kind of reintegrate him into the first team squad, which obviously isn't preferable. So you're just hoping that a resolution gets found at this point. And I still am doubtful Chilwell, because again, if I'm a club, as much as I love Ben Chilwell, if I'm a club, am I committing big funds to a player with that injury record? I'm not sure I am.
I mean, I think that, yeah, Ben Chilwell, the only club that really have actually shown any interest is Manchester United. And my argument for that case is I still even wouldn't send them to Manchester United. That's just strengthening another team around us, because Ben Chilwell, for me, I understand how people feel about his injury record, but he is, I think, comfortably still one of the best left backs of the club. Renato Vega obviously has come in, taken his place, but you know, I look at Ben Chilwell and I go, well, if there's a game where you want a bit of dynamism on that left hand side, Renato Vega comes inside, Cucurella comes inside. If we need someone who's really going to bomb forward and push on, Ben Chilwell is your only option in that situation. So I'd be intrigued to see what happens with that, and I think it's important to reintegrate him. I mean, look, Enzo Maresca, again, I rate his honesty. You know, where he basically turned around with that whole situation, Raheem Sterling, said, well, I told him on Friday, maybe you want to find a move because I don't know if you're going to fit into what we want to do. And he said the same to Ben Chilwell, where he was going, look, I think you're a great guy, but you don't fit.
I could see Chilwell doing an Alonso, where if I'm Ben Chilwell, okay, switch off the pod now if you don't want to hear really, I guess what you deem negative opinions, but this is just recent Chelsea history, right? If I'm Ben Chilwell and I'm advising Ben Chilwell, I'd be saying to him, listen, right, look at this club. It's had 5 managers in the last 2 years. Look at how the season started. If the season goes off the rails quickly, there's no guarantee this coach still remains in place. And it's the classic Chelsea player on a long contract, on good wages, who just sits around. Marcus Alonso under Frank Lampard sat around. He was excluded from the team basically for half a season. And he just waited his time. Thomas Tuchel comes in and suddenly he becomes a relevant player again. If I'm Ben Chilwell and I'm not forced out the club and someone doesn't come in for me before the end of the window, just bide your time, mate. Because maybe that doesn't work out for him and then maybe he has to leave in January. But I think there's as much a chance of him being reintegrated if a new coach comes in. Or maybe there's an injury crisis where suddenly Maresca has to look at Ben Chilwell because Vega gets injured, Cucurella gets injured. We know how precarious our injury situation has been in recent years. So because he's on a longer contract, it's not that the club can frame it as we really don't want him going into the last 6 months of his deal. We can't lose him for free. Well, no, you gave him a new contract extension in 2023. So yeah, it's and Chilwell hasn't done a Sterling where he's come out publicly and kind of potentially put himself in a situation where he doesn't have public support.
Yeah, no, it's going to be interesting to see how that all develops, because I think both Chilwell and Sterling are massive names which can have an impact on the squad in some way, shape or form. And you know, word does get round, let's put it that way. But anyway, we'll move swiftly on. You haven't got long left, guys. Obviously, if you've just turned it down because Dan's been, you know, really negative about Ben Chilwell and you hate Ben Chilwell and all this sort of stuff, then I'm really sorry. Please still give us a 5-star review, because this is the best chess podcast on the planet. As far as growing, that's a fact. But we'll move swiftly on now in to your match preview. But before me and Dan continue talking, and we're going to put Dan in the naughty corner for about 2 minutes here. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Stat Shaggers.
The Chelsea Echo presents Stat Shaggers.
Yes, it's that time again. Stats Shaggers, round 3 for the season, and already round 3 within pretty much a week. Such has been the already heavy involvement with Europe, hopefully now secure as well after the 2-0 win against Servette on Thursday night. So Chelsea against Wolves played 117 games over the years, 44 wins, 30 draws, 43 losses, so very, very close between the two teams, pretty much bang on even. Let's hope Wolves don't even up this weekend. Although the recent record is something to be concerned about if you are supporting the Blues. In the last 10 games, Chelsea have been very much second best when facing Wolves, both home and away. Wolves have won 4, including the last 3 in a row, and there have been 3 draws. Chelsea have only won 3, which was included a resounding 3-win in October 2022 and the infamous 5-2 win at Molineux in September 2019, when we all believed that Frank and Cobham were going to win the league. Generally, though, it has been pretty slim pickings against Wolves, winning only 1 of the last 8 against them. That was that 3-0 win under Graham Potter in October 2022. At Molineux itself, it's even more dire, I'll be honest. That 5-2 win was a massive anomaly, really. Chelsea have gone there and won That was their only win, I should say, since their return to the Premier League. Wolves returned to the Premier League in 2018. There have been four losses for Chelsea and one 0-0 draw. So it's really not been a happy hunting ground at all. And last year, Wolves, of course, even did the double over Chelsea, winning 4-2 at the Bridge in the most recent game with Mateus Cunha scoring a hat-trick. So, yeah, some games to forget in our recent past there. Onto the manager record. Well, again, Mr. Maresca has actually not faced Wolves, so there'll be no analysis at all to be done there for him. But he did get, his first Chelsea win and his first European win as a manager against Servette. So that's some positives. On to Gary O'Neill, the Wolves manager. He has now managed Chelsea four times, losing both times when manager of Bournemouth, but of course orchestrating the double last season when manager of Wolves. Now he traces an illustrious three wins in a row personally and four wins in a row over Chelsea for the club, a feat Wolves have not achieved since 1947. And it's back to you in the studio.
Gangs were talked about, numbers were said, and yeah, I stand by it. You know, I'm statistically still the best Chelsea manager to go to Molyneux since Frank Lampard in 2019. So, you know, that's that. That's your preview. Thanks, guys. Take care. See you later. No, we'll get into it. Dan, come on. Let's talk about Wolves. How do you feel? I just grin through the screen of pain and anguish, but also hoping that we get a result at the same time is so visible right now.
Yeah, obviously it's not great ground recently for Chelsea. Obviously we've taken one of their best players, and that is kind of going to be the big narrative, I'm sure, of the day. Whether Neto gets booed or not, I'm not entirely sure, but does he start? Obviously Joao Felix, does he have enough training in him to... I feel like Joao Felix will be in the squad. I don't think he'd start the game. And because the Servette performance wasn't that convincing, there isn't, this is going to sound weird, right? Because the Man City performance wasn't great. But like, if you tally it up against opposition, I don't think the Servette performance was better than the Man City one. So like, you kind of are like, do I go back to the team that play? I'm sorry.
It's so depressing.
I know. Me and my brother were sat there like, we're like, this isn't, I was sat there at like 50 minutes and I was like, is this better? Was this worse than the Man City performance? And he looked at me and was like, and it wasn't a no. So I was like, oh no.
It's like, panic stations, I think. Everyone's just a bit like, oh no, what's going to happen here? I have very little confidence, I'll be brutally honest.
I think that there isn't a great outlook at Wolves, to be fair. And Mané had a couple chances at Arsenal. It wasn't exactly a demolition for them, but Arsenal obviously just a higher quality of opposition in terms of like quality, because they've lost Neto. You're still looking at Hwang, who obviously provided a good outlet for them for goals last season. Gary O'Neill, I think, has done a good job there so far, but might be up against it. I think obviously maybe if you're a Wolves fan, the concern is that Out Nori could be making a move before the end of the window, but if he sticks around, obviously that's a good player to have. I feel like, you know, they've got Mario Lemina, they've still got Doherty, they've still got Sarr, so they've still got Premier League experience in the team. I just think it'll be quite a functional unit, and I think if you're Gary O'Neill, if you're Wolves, you're hoping that they just have quite a steady season where they're able to rack up enough points to kind of finish maybe mid-table and at best maybe be pushing for the top 10. And you're kind of looking at, let's hope there are three teams worse than us, which I still think there will be three teams worse than Wolves. I think Gary O'Neill's a very shrewd coach, and I think he's worked in some difficult conditions. You look at what he did at Bournemouth when a lot of people expected them to be relegated. He finished the season really well with them. Moves to Wolves, there's been concern about that club. He had a really respectable season last year. So based on just evidence, he seems to know what he's doing. I think for Chelsea, I still not entirely sure what the team's going to be, what is the best combination of players. Because I don't think putting Nkunku and Palmer, of course, there's concerns now about Palmer's injury. He felt something.
No, I've got an update on that. He's fine. He's actually not got a problem at all. They've already said that he'll be available for selection for Wolves. So, you know, I'm fine with that. I say that touching every piece of wood I can find in front of me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, obviously if he's fine, I think the big question is just in terms of Neto, Palmer, Nkunku, what is the configuration of that attack? Draft Felix, yeah, but I still don't think Felix starts this game personally. No? I mean, what would he have had, like 1-2 days training? Does he get thrown? Neto came off the bench against Man City, so I still think Neto probably starts this game. I mean, is it more of looking like a 4-2-3-1? But that's kind of going away from what Maresca wants to do. So I'm very confused in terms of what 11 gets put out here. I can't say with much confidence because neither performance kind of, I think you could make as much of an argument that some of the players who started against Servette should be starting against Wolves, but then, you know, a higher caliber of opposition against Man City. I feel like the defence is more certain, actually, despite all the defensive concerns we've had. I think Colwell and Fofana, for me, is my back two. I don't know if
I think that they were the most assured players, I think, in that Man City performance for me. They looked most comfortable. Benoit Badiashile's done nothing to look like he could potentially displace Levi Colwell. He still looks quite lackluster. I think since he's had that massive injury towards the back end of his first season at Chelsea, he's just not been the same player. So I think realistically you're looking at, Colwell, Fofana, left back, Sparky, right back, you're looking at Malo Gusto. I mean, goalkeeper, I know it's Servette, right? But Jorgensen just looks so much more comfortable on the ball, coming out, pushing a bit further forward. I was far more confident in his ability. So I'd personally start Jorgensen, but it'll probably be Sanchez in goal. You and I spoke about that midfield three, saying, you know, that realistically the double pivot with Lavia and Caicedo is a given, and it should be a configuration of probably Nkunku down the middle in the number 10, Jackson up front, Neto on the left, Palmer on the right. I think that just is fairly self-explanatory, but realistically I think we're going to probably see Enzo playing further forward again and not deliver again.
Yeah, because I think with that kind of formation you're kind of acting like we haven't changed head coach. You know, in a sense, you know, you're kind of just like, well, the 4-2-3-1 worked last year. It can kind of fluidly go into a back three. You can naturally see Nkunku and Palmer join Jackson as a centre forward. So, yeah, I think that's the big conundrum, because Enzo, I don't really see the point of playing him as a number 10. I think he operates better kind of as a number 8. He's not good enough to play as like a central midfielder in the sense. Off the ball, I just don't think he's good enough. So, but the fact that Enzo didn't start the game against Servette, you kind of look at that and go, well, does that mean he's going to start against Wolves? And I think that from an attacking point of view, it's really Maresca needs to start working on Palmer and Nkunku. I think those two in particular, because I think those two are vital players for Chelsea this season. I think it's finding a balance where both those players can work in their best areas on the same Chelsea team. I think that's, for me, the key. Giroud could maybe add something. Jackson, I have a lot of faith, will get better as the season goes on. Neto, I'm excited to see on the left. And in the midfield, Lavia and Caicedo, for me, are still the two midfielders I'm more confident of starting.
Absolutely.
I think it's more just, you want Palmer and Nkunku. For me, feasibly, I want Palmer and Nkunku to be key cogs, right, where they can cause a lot of havoc. They can work in between the lines. They can kind of, they have the freedom to go out wide when they can, but mostly they're working in between the opposing midfield and defence, where they have an ability to run beyond the ball. They have the ability to pick up the ball in central areas. And I'm sure that's how João Félix will be used as well. So I think for me, that's kind of the big thing in Chelsea's attack is using both Palmer and Nkunku, because that wasn't a privilege that Pochettino really had at all last season. So if you can work on those two, I think kind of the rest sorts itself out, because I think those two players are good enough to individually make things happen.
I agree. And I think it needs to happen, whether or not Palmer actually starts, because the little niggle, even if he's available for selection, I think maybe it might be worth just wrapping him in cotton wool and sort of reviewing our options, which is one of the big benefits of having so many options and such a massive squad now. You know, Noni Madueke can comfortably go in on the right-hand side. So we'll have to see what happens with that. But before Dan and I go, we'll hand you over to Enzo Maresca, because he obviously has some comments on the game against Servette and the game against Wolves.
Is there a chance that João Félix could play Sunday? If he is available, and for sure he can have, yeah, he can get chances to play.
Do you think he's ready to go straight in?
In terms of knowing the way we want to play, probably not yet. In terms of physicality, I think he's ready because he was already playing games there. So just to understand if he needs more time to understand the way we want to play. But overall, I think he can play.
So Pedro Neto going back to Wolves, do you think he's ready to start in the Premier League as well? And what exactly was it that you saw in him as a winger that you want from him?
Pedro, the last time he played 90 minutes was in February. So you can imagine a long time ago. So we need with him and with 7-8 more players, Romeo, Axel, Moy, with this kind of players, Wes, we need also to build a little bit the physical condition. Probably tonight for Pedro playing 65 or 60 minutes, probably to give him another game on Sunday probably is too early, but we see. And then Pedro is the kind of winger that is always, you see first half, always trying 1v1, and is creating momentum that I think is very important for the team.
Tonight, Philip Jorgensen started in goal. Is that the plan to play Jorgensen in the European games and Robert Sanchez in the Premier League games?
This is in this moment the plan, but the plan can change because I said many times, I judge the players about the level. So if the level continue to be the same, probably Robert will be Premier League when we play Premier League, and Philip in the Conference League or the Cup that we have. But at the end, it's just about performance.
Right, that's that then, ladies and gentlemen. You've had your podcast. You've had the highs. You've had the lows. You've had Dan being Dan. You've had me being me. And you've had Tom shagging some stats. But that has been the Chelsea Echo. Make sure you give us a 5-star review on any good platform that you're listening to us on. Make sure you engage with us on socials as well. And obviously, post-game, final score with the score will be back after the Wolves game. Dan, is there anything you want to add to the outgoing message to the wonderful people and the top 100 listeners in Australia?
Good day, mate.
Yeah, we're still a top 100 football podcast in Australia. So, yeah, love the Aussies. But aside from that, guys, thank you very much for listening. Take care of yourselves, and we'll see you later. Ta-da.